Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hola, socios. Hola, equipo. My name is Neil.
I'm Liam.
This is John Nurnberger from Kansas City, Missouri, USA.
Moray Field near Brisbane in Queensland.
Edinburgh.
Barcelona.
And I'm a socio.
I'm a socio.
I'm a socio of the Big Interview.
Hi there, I'm Liam from Edinburgh, and I'm a socio, because not only do you get to hear the world's top players speaking about their time on and off the park, you also get to hear Graham try and slip in a reference about Aberdeen in every show. Keep up the good work, guys.
From Backpage, I'm Neil White, and welcome to part two of this La Liga Q&A on the Big Inside View. The questions come from our socios, that's our members at patreon.com/GrahamHunter, and our answers, as ever, come from the host of the Big Interview. Joining me now live from Barcelona, Graham Hunter, good morning.
And a very good morning to you too. Hello, lovely people out there.
If you haven't heard part one yet, catch up, hear about who Graham likes outside the big three and why, and which players you should keep your eye on this season.
Yeah, okay, you've queued me up beautifully there, because I said in part one, the instant I stopped speaking about this, I'm going to kick myself. And it turned out to be true, because it felt like I was pinpointing maybe players, I was telling the truth about all of them that are worth watching, that will fascinate me. But it's the case that I remember watching last season Espanyol playing at Leganés in one of the weirdest games of the entire season. And there was a player who stood out because he scored two own goals and then scored at the other end. Now, his name was Marc Hermoso. And given that his upbringing was at Real Madrid and then a little loan at Valladolid, Espanyol haven't had very much of him. And I remember watching him last season, having not seen a great deal of him, but he stood out in that game because, irrespective of the crazy stats, the football he displayed was fabulous, I thought. A real educated left foot, but somebody who judged space well. Hermoso is somebody who, as soon as we finished recording yesterday, I remember thinking about his role in the defeat of Valencia. And although I said, look, Espanyol is a team that under Ruby has become worth watching, in answer to one of the questions, Hermoso, I think, merits being one of those outside bets where it's probably not the case that he's going to absolutely make everybody, you know, gobsmacked. But he is a footballer who I think stands for, what would you call it, the quality watermark of this league, in that wherever you look, you see a guy and you think, well, you know, that's somebody who I'm deeply impressed with and who plays the brand of football that will keep me tuned into this title chase. And the other one that I haven't seen a great deal of, but again, when he came on against Real Madrid in a match I was commenting on last season, Zubeldia, who's only just turned 21 and is in the heart of Garitano's midfielder, La Real, strikes me as somebody who's got a confidence on the ball, who wants to influence things positively whenever he's on it in midfield. I hope Garitano gives him the chance to show that he can fit into the sort of more disciplined, organised, reliable structure that Garitano brings and brought to win himself this job. But also, he's a guy who wants to do creative, daring, risky things when he's on the ball. In terms of talking about guys who don't get a lot of profile that I think are going to be worth watching, there you are. I've cheated and I've thrown two extra ones in.
Thanks very much. And for anybody who enjoys a little game of Football Manager or something like that, you have by now got a list of purchases for your next game. Let's get back to today's question. We're going to drop straight back into the socios questions. Here's one about Real Madrid from socio Merin Myrtle, who says, why hasn't Florentino Perez not pushed harder for signing a striker, I guess we'll get to this, and centre-back? Not even a low-cost stopgap. Madrid was troubled by the lack of goal scorers last year, even with Ronaldo around. Do you think Perez privately considers this a rebuilding year?
Well, Meriden has been slightly overtaken by, as we all often are, the end of the transfer market, because the first way to answer your question was that they genuinely thought that they would get Rodrigo. They think that Rodrigo is the right type of guy for somewhere between the descriptions that Meriden used, because no stopgap is Rodrigo, but his growing up was partially done at Real Madrid. He's in the form of his life. He's a good athlete. He's had added pressure put on his shoulders by his promotion to, you know, regularly being Spain's number one striker. You know, that comes and goes depending on who else is on form. But when you start Rodrigo against the then world champions, Germany, you see that Lopetegui, as was, really rated him. Now, Lopetegui promoted Rodrigo and gave him his most responsibility ever at Spain level, started him against Germany in one of the penultimate fixtures before Spain went to the World Cup. And Lopetegui's now Real Madrid manager. So the Rodrigo thing fits in every single way. Young, athletic, good goal-scoring record. Record goal-scoring total last season at Valencia. Under pressure at Valencia. He's grown up at Valencia. Marcelino's been good for him. Lopetegui loved him at Spain level. And Valencia went Predrag Mijatovic. Because there's an argument that the most vitriolic, nastiest and longest lasting ill feeling in my, maybe even in my life, never mind my reporting career, was Real Madrid pinching Peđa Mijatovic from Valencia. Now, he went on to score the winning goal in the 98 European Cup final for them, their first, I think, since 1966. And therefore, it was worth it for Real Madrid, well, at the time. But Valencia, even despite, I don't know, six changes of president since then, the fans and the Valencia media still hold Real Madrid in utter disgust. It is, Mijatovic is referred to every time there's a Valencia player that Real Madrid won. And guys, come in, Dieta told me that he'd have been a Real Madrid player had it not been for the Mijatovic effect.
What made that deal so poisonous?
Mijatovic was iconic at Valencia. And at the time, Valencia fought like tigers. Mijatovic was their magical player. Valencia at that stage were used to competing for the title. They believed that they had brought themselves into contention. The way in which Mijatovic was taken away, the types of bid, the way in which he was tapped up, the way in which it was played out in the media. This one just kind of unraveled with finger jabbing, with insults in the press, with people doubting Mijatovic's behaviour in it, to the point at which it got brutally nasty. I mean, brutally nasty. So what are we, 21 years later? And if I guess Rodrigo's about 26, 27. The only thing he knows about this is because he's now been told at the Mestalla. And, you know, I looked at Rodrigo's performance in, although he scored a brilliant goal against Atleti on day one, I looked at his performance at Espanyol, and in my opinion, his focus has been bitten away at, gnawed away at by this row. And in the end, and I think it was, you know, I was going to say previsible. What does that mean? Foreseeable. That Madrid were going to judge 80 million as too much for Rodrigo. In the end, that has been the case. And Mariano, whose footballing background, I think he was born in Catalonia. His footballing background is, you know, having been at Real Madrid, grown up at Real Madrid, being pushed out a year ago to go to Lyon with other players being favoured, notably, for example, Borja. Mariano, right from the start at Lyon, looked liberated, looked quick, looked aggressive, scored goals. And the really weird thing about all of this is that when Sevilla came in and pushed really hard for Mariano, because this is a player of definite ability, whether he's going to be enough to add the amount of goals and assists that eats away at the total that Ronaldo has taken with him to Juventus. And Meriden is asking, has Florentino made an arse of this summer? Because later on, Meriden's question is Lopetegui been thrown to the wolves? Well, that may happen at a certain stage of his career at Real Madrid. So, Merin, Julen Lopetegui, if he gets a swift kick to the quick to, they call it the zona nobile here, during his time as coach, it won't come as a surprise. But to pre-disaster him, no, Merin, no. Florentino Perez's ego and his success rate recently is so big that if you want to criticise him, then I think you must term it as a screw-up rather than a deliberate plan to leave his new coach high and dry. And going back to Mariano, the thing that's really interesting is that Jean-Marie Aulas, who's the president owner of Lyon, said in the 48 hours leading up to Mariano rejoining Madrid, you know, with Aulas making a decent profit on the deal, I would say a profit of in the region of 17, 18 million euros in a year. Aulas came out and said that when Sevilla came in for this striker, the evidence was that Mariano wanted to go back to Spain and he was going to say yes to Sevilla. And at that stage, Aulas phoned Florentino Perez and said, look, this kid that we bought from you a year ago is going to go back to Sevilla. Do you want him? Do you want him in the auction? And Florentino Perez said, no, he's not the type of footballer we want. Now, this was sometime over the last 2.5 weeks. And it feels and sounds like a slightly odd deal, this, in that Mariano has to get over the idea that not too many days ago, either Florentino Perez didn't fancy him, or Florentino Perez, having spoken to Aulas, went to Lopetegui and Lopetegui didn't fancy him. That is a hurdle to get over. Maybe it's been talked about in the negotiations. Merin doesn't ask about Sevilla as part of the question, but Sevilla now are left, albeit that they have a director of football and a plan which is, very much based on the way in which Monchi left things set up. The fact about this is that we've got Sevilla scrambling around at the very last moment, looking for a replacement for Mariano, who they believed that they were going to get, Merin. But your focus is on Real Madrid, and in Real Madrid's case, Mariano doesn't simply have the responsibility of coming in and adding to the goals that Bale, Asensio, and Benzema were supposed to give, and Borja were supposed to give to make the absence of Cristiano Ronaldo go away, disappear. He's got a problem in thinking, well, I wanted to come to Real Madrid. I told Aulas that was my destination. I wanted to go back and revindicate myself, to prove myself. Fine. But he's got to be looking over his shoulder and thinking, if the goals don't come promptly, is Florentino Perez going to be saying to Lopetegui, I told you he wasn't the guy? This has happened once before and it ended quite nicely for Isco, because if you remember when Isco was part of a fire sale, Merin, at Malaga, Zidane was pretty much sports director at the club then, not coach. And he said to Florentino Perez, Florentino had gone out and said, Isco doesn't get in our starting 11. And Zidane went, listen, chairman, listen, boss, get him, buy him. Now, you know, whatever, 4 European Cups later, that's played out quite nicely. So, good luck to Mariano. Centre-back terms, Vallejo, I believe in a lot. I think he's a very good footballer. Beyond that, Madrid are obviously worried about Vallejo's injury record. It's too regular that he gets a pull or a strain, and they find that difficult. Therefore, is it guaranteed that this is Vallejo's breakthrough season? No. Nor is it guaranteed that before the close of the market, Real Madrid won't go and buy another centre-back. And that's feasible. I think that they believe that they have the cover to get through a season there with Varane and Ramos and Nacho, and the knowledge that both Llorente and Casemiro could play at the back, plus Vallejo. Now, if they take a hard-nosed decision and say, Vallejo isn't for us this season, and they loan him out, then expect a purchase before the market closes. But for the meantime, we're left with the conclusion that this last couple of days since you sent in the question have been sore for Sevilla, profitable for Lyon, a dream come true for Mariano, testing times for Vallejo, and interesting times between Lopetegui and Florentino Perez, who'd have it any other way.
Okay, thank you, Merrin. If we're talking transfers, this seems like a good time to hear from socio Robin Hinson. Robin, thank you very much for sending in an audio question. And here you are.
Hi, Graham. My name is Robin. I'm a socio living in Brunei. I love the work you do. Keep it up, please. My question is, what do you think the opinion in La Liga and generally in Spain is on the Premier League's early transfer window deadline this year? Are they going to follow suit and adopt it, or do you think they're likely to keep the advantage, should we say, that they might get by staying open just a little bit longer? Thank you.
I'm not taking this question as an outright invite to come and holiday with you, Robin, but I think that's what you're hinting at. At any rate, it's funny about the transfer market because, yeah, there's been laughter, sometimes public, sometimes up the sleeve, at England closing its market unilaterally so early, but particularly after World Cup. And therefore, I want to give you a layered, honest answer. So, for example, the loudest refrain that caused the Premier League to close its market earlier than ever before was this argument that to have the main competition begin and the market still open is detrimental to certain players or certain squads in terms of they'll begin with one attitude and maybe a good star arrives or a good star is sold, and that can destabilise you in the first, pretty crucial first month of a league campaign. And the overriding logic was that if you could get your business done, that there's enough time to do business from the end of May to, let's call it middle August, then that adds to people's power of planning and reliability and so on and so forth. What it seems to me is that to inaugurate this, one, unilaterally, and two, in a World Cup season where it's much more difficult to get players, where because their attention is focused on the World Cup, they're in training camps from almost the moment that a season ends, and great business can still be done if you've planned for months, if you've got in touch with the selling club and the player and the agent and everything is packed in January, February, April, March, then a World Cup year doesn't affect you too much. If you're assessing or you've sacked your coach or you're bringing a new director of football and effectively you've thrown all the pieces up in the air and you're beginning again in April or May, then a World Cup summer really affects you badly, and also in your calibration of what kind of player you want and whether you trust a particular player or his agent, then what kind of World Cup they've had, what kind of state they're going to be in after it, all these things add to the difficulty of calibrating what is a good transfer move in terms of value added to your team, but also value in terms of the wages and the purchase and so on and so forth. It's a jungle out there at the best of times, but it's very difficult to get things right. And to be exposed in the way that the Premier League has been, that they can't buy any longer, but they can be bought from, has left directors of football, presidents, coaches in Spain scratching their heads a little bit, looking at them, thinking the Premier League is known as being robust, aggressive, rich, forward-thinking in many aspects. Therefore, the general vibe here in Spain has been they've allowed an Achilles heel because English clubs could still, in theory, be raided up until the point at which the market closes in other parts of the world. It's been staggered in that Italy's already closed, Spain is still open for business. At any rate, one thing that possibly gives Robin a hint to a new way is that Ernesto Valverde at Barcelona said very loudly the other day, it's crazy that the market is still open when we've started our competition. We've played the two Super Cups, European and Spanish, and by the time it closes, we're going to be through Jornada Tres, the third weekend of competitive La Liga football. Now, when you get senior winning coaches like that speaking out loudly, you have to admit that's the ripples in the pond that began to guide the Premier League to close early. So, you know, in summary, Spain thinks that it has given them an opportunity in certain instances to keep looking at English squads and saying, you know, with the Champions League draw made before the close of the Spanish market, there's an advantage. It's allowed Spanish clubs to relax differently about which players they won't be losing to the Premier League, which again is an advantage. But can I see a given future whereby Spain might fall into line with England and doesn't think, for so long as they're closing earlier than us, this gives us a massive competitive advantage? Robin, at some stage, I could imagine that happening, where the European Clubs Association asks its members for a harmonisation and takes into account the will of the coaches and the directors of football, who say, before the competitions begin, please close the market. In a given future, I could see that potentially happening. But at the moment, from everything I've heard, been told, read across Spanish football, the core opinion is that England has been a bit preemptive in this, has been a bit, if not naive, then it's given a competitive advantage to some people, some clubs in Spain.
Okay, so however long that advantage lasts for, it's in place, but the biggest transfer of the summer did not involve the English market. It was, of course, the move from Madrid to Juventus of Cristiano. And our next question concerns that. It's from socio Tom McCool, who asks, Graham, are there sponsor deals at Real Madrid that have immediate effect around the CR7 move? I'm curious, says Tom, if we might see the downside of the Galactico strategy in a market with values boosted by the Neymar move. Now, I guess you can talk in general about the impact of Ronaldo's departure of Madrid, the business and the brand, not just the football team.
Yeah, it's an interesting business analysis that Tom's made. The way that at the biggest clubs, particularly Real Madrid and Barcelona, this functions is that patently people come in attracted to Cristiano Ronaldo, but largely, and I don't want to make out here that I've got a dossier giving you every detail of Real Madrid's commercial relationship with Cristiano Ronaldo, because I'm reasonably sure the tax man didn't have that either. But what I know is that when this whole Galactico idea began to impact on the thinking of then the presidential contender, Florentino Perez, who stood a couple of times and or at least once didn't win the presidency, but as he approached 98, 99 and saw his predecessor, Lorenzo Sanz, in deep financial trouble, he reinvented an idea which, you know, was very explicitly taken from the middle 50s at Real Madrid, where President Santiago Bernabeu and his right-hand man, his vice president, who I think was Saporno, came up with the, without calling it Galacticos, came up with the identical idea. And really, you know, it's fine. I don't know who came up with the, you know, talent borrows, genius steals. The idea was reinvented wholly for the presidential campaign that won Florentino Perez power in the summer of 2000. And from that point onwards, his right-hand man, Jose Ángel Sánchez, who is qualified in the world of marketing and business rather than football, their idea was that, yeah, of course, Real Madrid is a massive brand, but they wanted to use the star. So this is building to Cristiano Ronaldo, but just as they used Ronaldo and Figo and Zidane and Beckham and blah, 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 Thomas Gravesen, to boost their brand, the deal that they came to with these Galactico stars was about image rights and how they were shared. So there were certain deals whereby if a player brought an existing sponsorship to his arrival at the club, then he'd keep it. But when big brands wanted to come and specifically sponsor a Galactico, or when Madrid were getting big deals, big sponsorship deals, investment deals, based upon Zidane or Beckham or Ronaldo being there, they came to a very complicated structure of negotiating who got the lion's share of what were called image rights. And in order to, you know, most players get a small sum as part of their contract for image rights, and the club then profits. In the case of the really powerful guys, where their agents came and said, look, your brand is big, your brand revolves around history, trophies, and the group of players, but we are, you know, we are Figo, we are Zidane, we are Beckham, we are Ronaldo's. And therefore, what they were able to do was negotiate a very, either a buyout of future image rights, like we'll give you X much as part of your contract, and then the image rights of deals that involve you at the club, we get the money, and that's a gamble upon whether by buying the player out of his future image rights, you've made the right financial guess, or we'll keep paying you X percent of what the deals we bring in while you're at the club. Now, that's a very rudimentary way that I've explained it. But in my, as far as my knowledge extends, there was no sponsorship deal that was important to Real Madrid that ended the instant that Cristiano Ronaldo left. And what's more, one of the things that Real Madrid are very good at is business strategy, marketing, monetizing. And although they didn't push him out, they knew that a time was coming over the next 24 months, maybe one more year after that, that Ronaldo was going to leave. And therefore, it didn't come out of the blue for them. And they've been coping with him knocking on the door, asking for more money and telling him that he's unhappy for two and a half seasons. So I don't know whether this is, Tom, sufficiently detailed for you. But when you talk about Neymar's move and the downside of the Galactico strategy, I'm not 100% certain that I know what you mean, in that certainly Neymar has had a gross effect on supposed transfer values. So, for example, Neymar going for the buyout clause of 222 has helped dictate that effectively Real Madrid, after 9 years, four Champions Leagues and a record amount of goals, Real Madrid got their original outlay back from Juventus. Now, that remains to me utterly unbelievable. I mean that word in all its force. Does the power of the Galacticos, if you're talking about the way in which Galacticos cost so much that it's almost impossible to monetize their signing because of what you've got to outlay in terms of a transfer fee and wages, and therefore what you attract in terms of sponsorship or other forms of revenue is harder to win back. Yeah, I think that's true. I think wages are on currently an almost unstoppable spiral, but I'm not convinced that the transfer fee is going to oscillate all the way towards the Neymar end of things. I think that will settle out, and I think there are a number of reasons for that. I think that often buyout clauses will help there. Players won't want to be trapped by clubs demanding exorbitant fees for them. And I think that it's also the case that there's an acknowledgement amongst the leading clubs, or there's almost like a pack mentality between what we used to call the old rich clubs and the what's called now state clubs. And I think that the clubs who are not funded by almost endless wealth, like Manchester City are and Paris Saint-Germain are, and who have to generate their money, I think that there's a push from them that that the outlays on players of Neymar's ability don't become the norm. Now, Tom, the one thing that would be stupid of me to not point out is that there is less of a shine, there's less of a shimmer to their marketability and to the types of new deals that they can attract without a Cristiano Ronaldo in peak. That's just a fact. And it's part of the reason that they wanted Neymar or Mbappe, and that it's to their very great misfortune that we're not, I don't think, going to know the result of UEFA's financial fair play investigation at Paris Saint-Germain soon enough for Madrid to understand whether Paris Saint-Germain have to offload one of those two stars or not. And I think that that's what they've been waiting for. And the purchase of Mariano indicates to me that they don't want to wait and risk whether that comes out or not. But do they need to add, to replace Cristiano's marketing shimmer more than simply his goals? Then Florentino Perez's answer to you, Tom, would be yes.
Okay, it's time for a question from our sponsors at Bet365. Graham, the guys have asked, how difficult will it be for Thibaut Courtois to get in the Real Madrid side ahead of Keylor Navas? It is a unique situation to have two stellar goalkeepers duking it out.
It's a brilliant question, and I'm right up for it, because I was commentating on Girona Real Madrid at the weekend, and the great value, as any journalist will tell you, any fan will tell you, about being at the ground rather than watching on TV is that you see the full panorama. Now, when Girona go 1-0 up, Real Madrid are working and puffing through their backside. They're looking a little bit slow, particularly Marcelo at the back. There's at least a minor opportunity, although my bet was that it was going to be 3-1 Madrid. You know, anti-post, that's what I had in mind. 4-1, I had the right idea, the right result, blah, 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 scoreline different. But at that moment, Marcelo was struggling and Girona were running at them, particularly Lozano, Borja, Porto were having all the fun of the fair. Now, at that point, it was really important for Keylor Navas to make a couple of big saves. He did so. Madrid are 1-1 after the penalty. It's worth saying, in answer to this question, that Courtois had been hinting on social media before the game that he was ready to start, that he'd been brilliant in training. Clearly, he wasn't using social media to influence Lopetegui, but the media picked up on it. And on the morning of the game, the two main Madrid papers had Courtois on the front page saying, you know, Courtois starts, Courtois is ready. So Keylor being picked wasn't unusual for Lopetegui because he's a loyal guy. And what's more, Lopetegui knows he's coming into a situation where his main strength is not his employers. It isn't the guy who hired him or pays his checks. It's the squad. The kids at Real Madrid, with whom he's won under 21 or under 19 titles, and, for example, Sergio Ramos, with whom he spent 2 years unbeaten as Spain coach from the end of the 2016 Euros until he was sacked in Krasnodar just before the 2018 World Cup. That's where the power lies. If these guys turn up for him and win trophies, then suddenly his job is much safer than just cozying up to Florentino Perez. So the idea of listening to Ramos and listening to the squad saying, we adore Keylor, we love this guy, so that it back explains to you, the socios, to Bet365, to Lopetegui, that when Florentino Perez tried to do Kepa's business from Athletic, Kepa, who Chelsea go out and break the world record for a keeper for 6 months later, when Madrid are about to do Kepa at a brutally low price of about 20 million euros, Zidane comes out and said, we don't need another keeper. No, thank you, Mr. President. Says it in public. When the David De Gea situation takes place, the story was Keylor Navas not wanting to leave Madrid, being told he was being sent to Manchester United, Keylor Navas and his wife being on the plane in tears, and openly admitting afterwards that they were both in floods of tears with snot running down their noses about the fact that they'd been booted out of Real Madrid, and then it's off. Suddenly he's got to go back there. This guy is a footballing ninja. Because from that point to this, it's been European Cup after European Cup after European Cup, and he has been in a group of the two or three most important players in those repeated Champions League victories. Yet here he is again with the president going, I'll tell you what, we're going to have Courtois because it's one in the eye to Atletico Madrid where Courtois became famous. I can stick two fingers up to the club and the fans and I can say, we've got your goalie. Courtois is patently extraordinarily good. It was a central reason for Belgium finishing third in the World Cup. It's a really good story. But going back to Girona, at the point at which it's 2-1 Madrid, and by no means are they clinging on, but Girona are in the game, little Porto, this sort of cannonball of a footballer, flicks the ball on for himself to chase after, goes one-on-one with Keylor Navas, and Navas is out like a rocket, gets to it first, despite having started at a disadvantage, and hoofs the ball clear. 60 seconds later, Girona have it again, Porto's in the corner, beats his man, crosses it over, Keylor comes and takes, and he looks up. And this is where the sliding doors moment comes that answers the Bet365 question. Keylor knows that at 2-1, he's classed across, he can take a percentage bet, he can roll it right to Carvajal, he can slow the game down, he can make sure that there's no mistakes, and he goes, no, all in. An overarm, he hurls the ball up in the air and lands it the full half length of the pitch away on Isco's right boot. Isco takes one touch, and the second touch is that release pass for Bale to run outside Muniesa and onto what is just a one-on-one chance with Bono, and he scores off his left foot. Absolutely fantastic pass by Isco. Great goal by Bale. And that's why everybody is in the left-hand corner of the pitch where Bale trots off to, leaping on each other, jumping. The 3 points are assured at 3-1. But hold on a second, and this answers your Courtois question. Where are Ramos and Nacho? They're running the other way. They sprint to Keylor Navas, leap on him, and hug him as if he scored the goal with his left foot. And they're like, you're the man. You are the man. And then once they've done that, they gently trot up the pitch to meet Bale coming back and give him a pat on his Welsh back. And Bale's done brilliantly. But the adoration that the players have for Keylor, the number of times he rescues them, his intensity of training, the fact that he never courts headlines, that he never complains, the fact that he's an underappreciated member of the squad outside the training ground, but revered within the training ground. The fact that one of the reasons that Zidane left, I stress this, one of the reasons Zidane left was that he saw interference by the president on who was going to be the titular, the first choice goalkeeper. And Zidane didn't like it. He knew how the team felt about Keylor and the value of Keylor. Does that not begin to answer the Bet365 question about how difficult will it be for Courtois? Now, my bet is, because Courtois is a competitive animal, he's going to soak up that experience, the disappointment that he must feel of not starting against Girona, because the solution will be that the competitions are split. But you can see on his face a realisation of, ooh, this one's going to be a bit stickier than I thought it was going to be. And finally, I know in the UK it's not necessarily the norm. It's not even, I think, well thought of now that Guardiola is there and he's tried it. But in Spain, two keepers duking it out is normal. One of them getting cup competitions, one of them getting the league is normal. It's one of the reasons that Kepa hasn't got any European experience for club, because he was left on the bench in the Europa League matches that I think Iago Herrera played, while Kepa was the number one keeper. But a better example still was when Marc-Andre Ter Stegen and Claudio Bravo joined Barcelona in the same summer. One of them selected by the director of football, Zubizarreta. One of them selected by the coach, Luis Enrique. They, as you said, duked it out. And it seemed to go quite well in that Claudio Bravo won Barca the league and Ter Stegen won Barcelona the cup and the Champions League. So trebles come where great keepers duke it out.
Okay, still from your description, sounds more like a problem than a luxury, but maybe that's because I'm not used to seeing such. And I wonder if Courtois signed up for playing in just the league games or just the knockout competitions when he decided to leave Stamford Bridge for Madrid.
Well, let him open his can of spinach, gulp it down and get all Popeye over the problem in that case. Let him up his level daily, not in matches, but daily. Let it be an opportunity, let it be a positive.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Okay, thank you, Bet365. And thank you and hello, socio Richard Cook, who wants to talk about Leo Messi. So let's do just that. Richard says, I had a question about the great man at Barca, now made captain and having lost great leaders in recent years, mainly Xavi and Iniesta. How do you think he will perform the role full time and how do you think it will impact on his game? Richard brings up the fact that he has maybe struggled with the weight of expectation as the leader and captain of Argentina. And also, how do you think he'll be affected by the fact that his big rival Cristiano has moved on? Richard believes that they spurred each other on.
Yeah, Richard, I think there's two easy ways to begin this. One, PK spoke about this recently and he was bang on the money. Messi's been a leader pretty much from the day he walked into this first team. Yeah, he was more timid. Yes, occasionally his body shape was different. His hair was longer. His goal totals varied until he became the greatest footballer in the world. But leadership, as Richard knows very well, isn't solely based on the armband. So you've got a core to build on there that for many, many years, while all of us, Richard included, have been watching him, the players around him at Barcelona have considered Leo Messi as their outright leader. Now, that helps. Secondly, you don't inherit the armband simply on seniority. It's by popular acclaim. The leaders of the dressing room get together and work out who they want to be their captain. And if Messi didn't have the captain's armband, he would remain team leader in that his wishes, his mood, his decisions, his state of fitness, his attitude, whether he does or doesn't insist on playing every game, all these things dictate the rhythm of Barcelona's training week anyway. Now, on the pitch, I think there's a big, big argument about what does a captain's armband mean. And in some instances, particularly with the kind of poison chalice feeling about an England captain armband, in recent years, I've heard every argument exposed. What you have to remember is that there's a captaincy system at Football Club Barcelona. So, for example, there are four of them, and they're sub-captains. Leo Messi is the out-and-out captain. But recently, when the announcement from La Liga that there was going to be a game for the next 15 years, played one game per season, played in the United States, the Players' Union, AFE, said, "Now we're not happy about this, we've not been consulted. All the captains are called to a meeting in Madrid." It wasn't first captain Leo Messi who went. And therefore, I think he sent Sergio Busquets, and Sergio Roberto might even have been there too. But Messi doesn't necessarily see that as part of his captain portfolio. There's a system there. There's a group. There's this quartet of guys who will apply their particular strengths to particular questions that come up and face a captain. And it is also the case that the captaincy team at Barcelona negotiate, and I know from having spoken to various managers and directors at Football Club Barcelona, that the captaincy team can negotiate brutally on behalf of the squad in terms of bonuses, who participates in which sponsorship events. These are just examples of how there's a broad spectrum of what a captain does at Football Club Barcelona and Real Madrid, because it's very nearly identical. So, for example, Leo Messi has already hosted a get-together, barbecue, begin the season, good feeling, they call it a terpina, make the group into a tight-knit, unified group. And there'll be sort of barbecues and restaurant dinners throughout the season, both at good times and bad times, where effectively Messi will be the one who says, "It's this Thursday," or, "Boss, we want the day off." These things probably don't matter much more than trivia to socios who want to see what does a captain do on the pitch. I'll absolutely, thoroughly admit to you, Richard, that when he was first made captain of Argentina, I was a little bit surprised, particularly as in that instance the captaincy was stripped away from a natural born leader in Javier Mascherano. And then I heard Mascherano saying, "I understand, it's okay, he's the right guy." When I saw Iniesta, knowing that he carried a similar feeling of leadership because of his deeds and his attitude and his reliability and how much people around the dressing room liked him, still being captain, being front and centre, I didn't think would suit Andres Iniesta. But boy, he took it very seriously, coped with the things that he didn't particularly like doing. And while it would be foolish to talk about Iniesta or Xavi or Messi and say the armband meant that they gave more, but boy, neither Xavi nor Iniesta was any happier about losing or failing to achieve their targets once they wore the armbands. Let's put it like that. And the same will be true of Messi. Does it guarantee that we see the best Messi of all time? No. Does it guarantee a treble? Of course not. Does it guarantee that Messi gives more, concentrates more, is more intense in his desire to win trophies this season of all seasons? I think yes. And finally, on the Cristiano thing, nobody can prove it, Richard. Nobody can say definitively here's the case, but I've spoken to each of them sufficiently, listened to each of them speaking sufficiently, and watched them for at least my position to be absolutely clear that Cristiano was spurred on by Messi, that he loved hating Messi, in inverted commas. Because if you listen back to our Quentin Fortune interview, Quentin talked about if people taunted him or teased him about his teeth or his skin or his clothes, when Rio Ferdinand talked about Cristiano like being beaten once at table tennis, buying a table tennis table, playing consistently for 2 weeks non-stop until he could come back and thrash Rio at table tennis in revenge, that's what helps make Cristiano great. Leo Messi is not built that way. Messi is driven by a love of the ball, a love of winning. Messi was good for Ronaldo. Ronaldo, in my book, was next to irrelevant to Messi.
Fascinating. Thanks to another of our socios at patreon.com/GrahamHunter, Aditya Prabhakar, for this next one. This comes all the way from Australia, which is relevant, as you'll hear in the question, and also because you're on the telly there. The subject is burnout. With the schedule looking more compact with every season, says Aditya, and the potential of a game happening in the US, does football need to look at other sports to help players recover? Are we expecting too much from these players? Aditya raises the AFL over there and also the NFL's use of scheduling to restrict the physical demands on athletes. What do you think, Graham?
I think it's really obvious that certain sporting calendars probably allow their athletes more concerted time to recover. I think that there are certain sports whereby it's a lot more aggressive about how to protect their athletes from impact injuries, concussion, rest. And I think that football stands in the dock a little bit. Right now, I think that there is a lack of coordination about football saying, okay, we know we're squeezing every last drop out of our footballers, but it's not really me, or it's not really our division of football, or it's kind of them. Whereas in fact, if you stand back as a footballer, an agent, a parent, nobody's doing enough about it at a time when we hear the head of FIFA, Infantini, proposing that, you know, Pluto and Mars should be involved in the next World Cup, and that, you know, why don't we make it an intergalactic tournament? I'm genuinely afraid that, to go back to the nub of Aditya's question, in terms of protection, in terms of recuperation, football has never been better in one way. There has never been more scientific knowledge and practice about how to turn footballers round from being physically drained in terms of their vitamins and minerals. There's never been better knowledge of when they need to rest, how often they need to rest, exactly what state they're in if they play a game 3 nights apart compared to 4 nights apart. The level of detail there and the amount that's expended on physios, recuperators, fitness trainers, dietitians, sleep coaches, it's extraordinary, to the extent that footballers are generally in the elite level in better condition than they'll ever be in their life. However, two things come to mind. At the moment, we're careering down a path where we're going to ask more and more of them physically, but broadly, too few people who control football care about the physical state of the players, and too few people who control football either care or know about a different kind of burnout, which I'm absolutely bet that Aditya is talking about, which is the creative burnout. We want these players to entertain us, not just to be fit to be on the pitch 69, 70 times a season, or 80 times a season if you talk about club and country. We want them to do things that make us go, wow, I'm so glad I sponsored this sport. I'm so glad I bought a ticket for €95. I'm so glad I travelled abroad with my team. I'm so glad I bought my £2,500 season ticket. I'm so glad I've introduced my kids to the sport. That's what we want from them. And when burnout comes into question, it's about the burnout of people being able to do that that really worries me. And that's why I'm still, to this moment, stunned that the Russian World Cup was played in such a manner that people, you know, drooled over it potentially being pound for pound the best World Cup ever. Because it was played, you know, flat out, and for 90% of the matches, end to end, flat out Champions League brand football. But can we count on that going on forever if we keep burning them out mentally? Then my honest opinion is no. And it does worry me. And I'm glad that that question got asked.
Yeah, sports science versus economics, I think, for that one. And unfortunately, economics usually trumps all.
Morality and conscience has to come into it too.
Yeah, you'd hope. Thank you very much, Cynthia. It was an unusual and interesting question. Thanks for your response, Graham. Okay, we're going to have one more audio question. This one's about something that concerns you personally, Mr. Hunter. It's from Richard Cosmala.
Hi, Graham. It's Richard Cosmala in Huddersfield. Hope you're well. I wondered if I could have your views on the fact that Sky Sports are no longer showing La Liga. Do you think it'll do some damage to La Ligas, especially in the UK, the fact that we can only watch through an app now or through a specialist channel? I personally think it's great. Obviously, we can watch now La Liga TV, 11 Sports, but do you think that only kind of the real keenos like myself will subscribe to this and potentially La Liga could lose a lot of interest in the UK?
Richard and I speak often on Twitter. I am able to speak on behalf of the good of the Spanish game and La Liga rather than any personal interest. I'll make a firm contention, Richard, that the wide availability, although it was a subscription channel, the wide availability of Sky in British homes from the mid-90s when they bought the Spanish rights first, I think it was 95, 96, something like that. I've argued many times, either on the podcast or in writing in the Barca book, that the lads asked me to publish, that it was inevitable that the ripple effect of seeing how not only another brand of football, which was a successful brand of football, was played, plus the commentators on the live matches would talk about how development was important and what type of skill training there was, what kind of belief there was in what's called football base over here, youth football. And therefore that overall picture, not just the glorious skills of La Liga at a time when Spain has been the dominant force in European football by a long way, both club and international. So the fruits of what Richard's talking about are evident, and the fact that the root and branch labour which produced those fruits was available for people to see. And I mean the broadest range of people, whether that is just fans, but also coaches, young footballers, football developers.
I think it's worth saying that you know, in several of the big interviews that we've done over the past 3 and a bit years, lots of the guys that you've sat down with have mentioned at some point being influenced by watching that football on Sky.
Yeah. You can be still more dramatic if you accept the fact that Gareth Bale, on leaving Spurs, is in a phone conversation with Ryan Giggs, who, you know, given Bale's proud Welsh heritage, but also proud aspirations to do well for his country, must regard Giggs as one of their greatest ever players. But Giggs is there. He must be top 1, 2, 3 of all times in Wales. And at that stage, he's at Manchester United. And tells Bale, our club will pay the same fee to Tottenham. We'll pay you more wages than Real Madrid. Join us now. And Gareth Bale says, no. I'm going to a country where I know I'm not going to be able to speak the language. But I'm going to Real Madrid because I've grown up, in football terms, watching Real Madrid. And that's where I want to be 4 European Cups later. There's one person in history who's got more Champions League medals than Gareth Bale, and that's Cristiano Ronaldo. And there are 4 footballers, I think, who've got more European Cup lifts than Gareth Bale. And those 4 would be Maldini, Paco Gento, Di Stefano, and Cristiano Ronaldo. So that choice he made, which was wholly based on the fact that he could watch Real Madrid on television each week, has led him to an unbelievable return on his decision to say, it's my dream to play for Real Madrid. It was Cristiano Ronaldo's dream to play for Real Madrid. It's at the point when Spanish football in 2009 is hugely well known, hugely well watched and understood in Britain, that he can say to Ferguson, my dream is to go and play there. You must let me fulfil my dream. It's Raheem Sterling's dream to go and play at Real Madrid. And therefore, I agree with you, what you've said, Neil. We have found a level of fascination in the professional game, Richard, that, as you've been listening in, you'll know, with not what happens in La Liga, but the how and why. So, yes, when an era like that comes to an end, Richard, there's natural regret. And I have very little to do with 11, their owners, why they're investing, what they propose to do over the stretch of their contract. I know the man who's been hired by 11 to produce the broadcast side of it, and he's very, very good. But will it necessarily be as widely seen in Britain and Ireland as Sky was? No, because just like establishing a podcast culture, establishing the culture of watching streaming football or streaming football programmes on an app is new. It's different.
Final question from our final socio of the day, Ian Gardner, you're up. Ian says, hi Graham, not strictly a question about the upcoming La Liga season, but Ian will let you in anyway. Having observed the almost godlike reverence to Pep Guardiola in the British media just now, particularly off the back of the new Man City docuseries, which, funnily enough, given what you've just been talking about, is exclusive to Amazon Prime, would you agree he is now worshipped more in England than he was by the Spanish media when conquering all before him with his great Barcelona side?
When Pep Guardiola was appointed as Barca B coach in 2007, there was no media profile to it. It was a snippet. When he took over in 2008 at the first team level, there was decent coverage, particularly on the day that he announced, I tell you what, well, there's the backdoor Deco and Ronaldinho and Eto'o. That got a bit of coverage. But in the days leading up to his actual presentation, when it was announced that Pep Guardiola was the chosen one ahead of the special one, the coverage wasn't big. The Euro 2008 was on. Spain were beginning to gather momentum. So from that point onwards until the end of his reign at Barcelona 4 years later, the coverage varied wildly. And that even within Catalonia, there were people who certainly never gave him reverence because he is spiky, demanding, occasionally contrary. And therefore, while I could name you many people within the football industry and within the Catalan media sector who do revere him, it's definitely the case that the Madrid media thought, well, we'll set ourselves up in opposition. We'll try and make it harder for Guardiola to have this magic guru effect on the country because we'll pick up his faults. And he didn't give one-on-one interviews, apart from, I think, I had two. There were two or three other people who, based on circumstances, had one-on-one interviews, but that's very rare. So the media, in terms of reverence, are human, and therefore if a manager or a player is broadly spreading one-on-one interviews around the industry, they'll get slightly more generous coverage. It's a simple truth. Right now, I have to say that at the moment and over the last 12 months, I agree with your contention. You know, beer in a bar is just a beer. A beer in the desert is the most beautiful thing you've ever seen in your life. And I think, Ian, you know what I'm saying. England wasn't a wasteland, but the types of football that you see from Guardiola's team, the way in which he talks, trains, argues, buys, teaches, the way in which he stands opposed to intelligence isn't everything. Spirit is. When you come preaching the opposite of these things, you implement it, it succeeds, you set records, you begin to talk to the media much more, you begin to give longer press conferences, you begin to dominate English more than he dominated German. When young English players improve under him, then irrespective of the nonsense that was spoken before his appointment and throughout a big chunk of his first season, now, maybe it's the case that that the reverence might go overboard. And there'll be something this season where the tide will turn, the reverence will diminish, because that's just what appetites do. But did any of that really count? Any of that really count set against the achievements in Spain or in Germany or over his first two seasons in England? I don't think, personally, Ian, it does. But the value of Pep Guardiola is not whether he's now liked and revered and given a different profile in England. The value is his teaching, the evidence he leaves to other coaches. It's the same as the Sky Sports question for Richard previously. Guardiola's major importance to football isn't to the teams with whom he's won trophies. It's for his perpetration of the idea that Cruyff is, in my book, principally responsible for, which is football as brilliance, football as thrill, football as flair, but football as plannable, football as scientific. That's his value. If he's revered in England right now because of what he's doing at City and the press is good, fine. Easier for him to keep on doing what he's doing. Is that going to last the length of this season? Personally, I have my doubts. But is it merited, Ian? Yes.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you, Graham. Thank you, Socios, for these questions. And that's our show for today. If you want to join the Socios, the guys that get to participate in these monthly Q&As and get exclusive content, including big interviews that the rest of you don't get to listen to, then sign up at patreon.com/Graham Hunter. We'll be back very soon with more big interviews.
We will be. But before we go, I'll also say something about one of our most long-standing socios, Raza Hussain, a great football lover, a personal friend of mine, who's just needing a little bit of hospital time at the moment to put things right. I'm certain that while he's in hospital, he and I will still continue to exchange opinions about football. He's one of the guys who makes the world better as a QC, who represents people who don't have a voice and who have been done great injustices. He's one of the people I most admire. And therefore, Raza, as you're listening to this, get well soon, bro.
Thank you for joining us for season 2018-19. We've got huge creative plans for the months ahead, but we do need your help to make them happen. Please go right now to patreon.com/Graham Hunter and become a socio, become a paying member. Get an extra big interview every month, plus loads of bonus content. Last season, socios listened to 9 exclusive big interviews, including Rafa van der Vaart, Troy Deeney, Roberto Di Matteo, and loads of me talking about football. The Premier League, the Champions League, Spanish football. I'm sure they enjoyed it and you will too. Support us, join us. Thank you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.